copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Welcome to the session on intercultural teams and missions, and I've called this kind of a roadmap to effective intercultural teams. And it's drawn from cross-cultural competency research on an individual level, but it also is drawn from the Globe Studies on Leadership, a comparison of national values across cultures. So it's building off a lot of things that I'm pulling together, and as you can tell, I love pictures. And so that's the reason it's the graphic. This is a Prezi. If you've not seen one before, you can perhaps get a little dizzy if it does any turning on you. I've tried to avoid too much spinning and turning with it. But the framework, as I said here, is looking at intercultural teams and how to develop effectiveness in it. Europe, perhaps more than any other place, has intercultural teams by virtue of the fact that you've always got people from different countries, even within the continent. And so when we look at this, I will look at a team that I have specifically composed for this. But this draws from secular literature, and it does draw from Christian literature as well. The top two rows are cross-cultural communication type things. It would be very good if I had put one of Dr. Elmer's books in there, but I've got them listed as possible resources for people to use. And then the bottom draws from the Globe Study, which is an ongoing study that involves over 300 scholars exploring 75 different countries. 62 is what it says in the first book, but they keep adding on to it. And it's been an absolutely massive social study that's the most intensive thing that's ever been done looking at leadership styles and looking at cultural values in relation to leadership. It's not hard to read, but it's hard to wade through and distill things that are helpful for you. I think it took me 3 or 4 weeks the first time to distill things down to a stage where they would be helpful for people to try and understand some things. Yeah, so the intercultural team that I'm going to use as my example here is an American, a Swede, a German, and a South Korean. I'm drawing on countries that are sending out a lot of missionaries, and my apologies if it doesn't include any of you here in the room, and my apologies if it does include some of you in the room, because you might not like what I have to say about you. We'll hear from you later in the question time, I believe. First, in terms of the Globe Study practices taken from these three books, this was the bottom row, so I haven't changed anything on that. Sorry, I have to come down here. And what this does, and I am going to get up and move around right now, this takes each set of values that the Globe Study looked at, all 9 of them, and then it just shows you where they are in relation to each other. So you can see in-group collectivism, the Koreans were the highest of all those. Gender egalitarianism, the Koreans were the lowest. They tend to be male-dominated. Power distance, the Koreans were the highest. Uncertainty avoidance, they were the lowest. They're more the most relaxed around needing rules. And we'll talk about a few of those values, but this just gives you an idea of the depth of looking at. When you have 9 dimensions to consider, there are a lot of ways people can vary from each other. And those of you who are familiar with Hofstadter's research, he looks at 5 different values instead of the 9. These reframe some of the things that he does. They look at 2 different types of collectivism instead of just 1. And they do have gender egalitarianism, power distance, and future orientation. So they have several of the things that he looks at. But they also add performance orientation and assertiveness. Who's the most assertive there? And who's the least assertive? You can see Sweden is the least assertive. USA tends to be the most. The Germans are hiding. I think they're just behind the Americans in there, but we'll see this in a second. So when you look at each of these sets of values, all I've done is taken the 4 countries that we mentioned here. These are not on the scale of all the countries in the study. This is just of this particular team, who is likely, if they follow the country values, to be most assertive. Who's likely to be least assertive. The thing you have to be careful with is not committing what's called the ecological fallacy that says Koreans are assertive, therefore this Korean must be assertive. It's a false way of equating things. All it says is, by and large, Koreans will be more assertive or less assertive than somebody that they're compared with. So again, when I look at assertiveness, Germany ranks highest of the four countries and Sweden is the lowest. So in a group meeting, let's say they follow these stereotypes, it's more likely the German will be asserting himself or herself in the meeting, and the Swede will be more reticent to hang back. Of the four that we've listed in the group there, the degree to which individuals are assertive, confrontational, and aggressive in their relationships with others. My first trip to Germany to speak at a conference, I was told I need to get a taxi, and I had the name of the street, and I tried to pronounce the name because I didn't know if the taxi driver spoke any English, and he just looked at me and he said, "Your German is atrocious." And I said to him, "Well, no, my German is non-existent, but since I know you speak English now, I can point this to you, and you know where to drop me off." But that fit right into the stereotype of the assertiveness framework. When it comes to gender egalitarianism, the Swedes are highest. I saw one of the workshops said what to do if you're a woman and you're called into leadership, and I think what you do is you move to Sweden. They will give you a better opportunity to exhibit the gifts that you sense that God has given to you. South Koreans are the lowest. I just taught a course in South Korea for doctoral students, and it was 10 males, and all the leadership in the churches is largely male. One of the interesting things is in a place like South Korea, when a woman is in leadership, she has to act like a man, or she won't be respected. If she acts like a Korean woman, a typical Korean woman, she will not be respected. And you see this on a regular basis in countries which have a sharp distinguishing of the gender roles. And the males usually are those in power in countries and cultures that do this. South Korea, largest in in-group collectivism, the degree to which individuals express pride, loyalty, and cohesiveness in their organizations or their families, the Swedes value that the least. How does that show up? You don't want to diss a Korean's family member, a grandfather, somebody older in particular. And it's not that the Swede really likes that, but the Swede can roll with that in the stereotype. The South Korean is more likely to take offense at something related to family or organization. And as the organization goes, so goes the reputation of the South Korean. Whereas the Swede is more likely to distinguish themselves from the organization. So for example, I'm from a country that's in the middle of those two, and when I think of whether you associate me with our newest president, and whether you read the press about white evangelicals, of which I am one, voted 80% in favor of our president, you might say to yourself, well, he must be a Trump supporter. And I can say to you, you're dead wrong, because that's applying the ecological fallacy to somebody who fits in the category, but I feel comfortable distancing myself from his policies and his actions as an American, whereas a South Korean might have a harder time with that. And there's been some real challenges with the new president being elected in South Korea. I was there when the Supreme Court upheld the decision to impeach the South Korean president, and there were two sets of rioters, one in favor of the decision, one very upset with the decision. Masses of thousands, and they were separated by several blocks and several hundred police, and one side was the older generation who was very much in favor of the then current president, and one was the younger generation who was very much against it. And I asked my friends, it was a unanimous vote of the Supreme Court, and they said yes, because the Supreme Court knew if they didn't all vote together, it would tear the country apart. So no matter how some of them felt, they decided they would vote in this way to support the country as a whole rather than to support their individual decision. So you can see how this can get played out in present real day life. Performance orientation in South Korea, a very high performance orientation, a ministry university Bible fellowship. You're ranked in the ministry by how well you do in the ministry. How many people are in your group? How big your university movement is, and I see this on a regular basis among Koreans around the world. Of course they have the largest church in the world. There's one sense in which that's a deep part of the cultural value of performance, and if you don't have a church of several thousand, you're not really a success story as far as the Koreans are concerned. Sweden, doesn't care about performance on a relative scale. It doesn't mean the Swedes don't care about performance, period. But compared to the Koreans, they're much lower. Power distance is the degree to which members expect power to be equalized among all members or distributed so that somebody's always at the top and somebody's always at the bottom. And those that flatten this out are called low power distance societies. Those that spread it out are called large power distances. Large and small are the terms that are often used. But South Koreans have the highest power distance separation. The Swedes have the lower power distance separation. Swedes in a decision-making meeting want to go around each other, round and round, and make sure that everybody is heard before they come to a conclusion. They might come to a consensus conclusion, but the Korean leadership will announce what the consensus conclusion is, rather than having people go around in circles and try and figure out what it is. So when I'm looking at this, then I, as I said, this draws, I'm standing up again here, from intercultural communication research and the reality of what it's like for a person to adjust to a new cultural setting. And we've identified four stages that people go through. I say we. Social scientists have identified four stages. The first stage is usually, in scientific terms, the unconscious incompetence stage. You're incompetent as a team member because you don't know the other cultures of the members of your team, but you don't know that you're incompetent yet. And that's the honeymoon phase, when everybody is excited about being part of a new team, and the team seems to be functioning well. And yes, the South Korean will be there right on time. The Swede might arrive a few minutes late. The American will usually be within 5 minutes. The German, of course, is going to be extremely punctual. So in terms of time, you might not have a problem. But when it comes to performance, the Germans and the Koreans are going to be assertive and performance-oriented, and the Swede doesn't care about those kind of things. And it begins to come out in team meetings. It begins to come out in things like performance evaluations. But until you get past this stage, you haven't really formed a team yet, just as a marriage in the first year is a marriage, but it's not yet settled into what it will become. Because you have to go through some rockiness before you reach that. Unless you have a really unnatural marriage, which means you just stayed in the honeymoon for X years. I did not stay in a honeymoon for that long. Goodwill is there, and people are testing the waters with each other, and typically each person's natural cultural inclinations are dominant in the group. And the group does not yet have a shared team identity. They have an identity of each individual, but they don't yet have a cohesiveness. Okay, then we move on to the next phase, and this next phase is where you begin to come into conflict. We talk about culture shock for individuals, and I've just coined the idea of team shock. It's always interesting to hear Americans who have been on short-term mission trips because they talk about having gone on culture shock, and I kind of laugh because they've not been there long enough to get into culture shock. Culture shock is when you realize either you change or you die. And that usually takes 6 minutes, that's an American version, 6 months to 18 months before you hit that wall and you realize, okay, this is no longer cute. This is no longer fascinating. This is no longer interesting. This is no longer just different. I don't like this. Whatever this might happen to be. And either I change or, in some cases, I try and change the local culture. That does not go well, by the way, when you try and do that. I was in the Philippines, and I had been in the Philippines an hour, so I'm almost an expert on American terms. And riding home from the airport, yes, you were supposed to laugh at that. Riding to where I was going to say from the airport, I was watching traffic patterns. It was 10:30 at night on a Saturday night, and I asked the driver, who was an American missionary who had been in the Philippines for 15 years. I said, tell me, are traffic lights suggestive or imperative here? And he said, oh, the traffic lights are suggestive. And then he came up to a left turn light, and he stopped. And he waited, and there was no traffic coming from the other direction. He had a couple of cars behind him, and they honked their horns in a gentle Filipino way, saying, we're here. Are you going to do something? And he just stayed there, so they drove around him to make the left-hand turn against traffic, because there were no light. There were no cars coming on, and the light changed, and he drove off. And I asked him, okay, tell me what just happened. You said traffic lights are suggestive, and yet you stopped there, and there was no traffic coming on. He said, I'm trying to teach the Filipinos how to drive. And I didn't say anything, but I thought to myself, you're only teaching them that you're an idiot. And I thought, I've been in the country 1 hour. You know, I'm not sure how deeply I want to insult this American missionary, but sometimes people have been there 15 years, but it's 15 times 1 year, just repeated that 1 year over and over and over again. So he was still in a phase of cultural shock because they hadn't learned yet how to drive by watching his example. And I can't say this, the next time I went to the Philippines, I was in the car with somebody who had been there 25 years, and I could see he knew the dance. And so I asked him, what are some rules of driving in the Philippines that I would need to know if I was going to live here? He said, well, two rules. One, if your bumper is 1 centimeter in front of the next person, you have the right of way. But two, if you get into an accident, it's the nicer car that's at fault. Because the owner of the nicer car has more money and can pay for the repair of the cheaper car. So that it doesn't matter who caused it. No, who caused it is the person driving the nicer car. I thought, that doesn't make sense to me. But obviously, he had reached a stage, the fourth stage, we'll talk about a stage of unconscious competence. He didn't have to think about it anymore. This stage now, you've become aware that you're not competent. And you're struggling with that. And so you get aware of the differences, and the warts begin to impact the team dynamics and energy, and you walk through issues of leadership style. Who's the leader on our imaginary team? Who would you like to make the leader? You want the South Korean, the Swede, the German, or the American? The Swede. Okay. So we'll put the kind, gender egalitarian, low assertive Swede as the team leader. How do you think the German's going to feel about that Swede or the South Korean who wants direction from the leader rather than the leader getting direction from the South Korean and the American? It will be a good challenge, won't it? It doesn't mean that Swedes can adapt, so please don't misunderstand what I'm saying. If we're following just the framing, it's an international team, or in an international team, nobody is normal. All of you are abnormal. This is not as alarming as it sounds, but the team leader must bear in mind that colleagues have their own perspectives on other nationalities. And we'll talk about what that means. So now we're talking stereotypes about foreigners. German stereotypes about foreigners. They tend to be unpunctual, inefficient, undisciplined, flippant. Germans don't, as a stereotype, like flippant humor. And so American side cracks and jokes are something that Germans don't always appreciate the way Americans do. South Koreans think of foreigners as impatient, loud, possibly lazy, and uncommitted, disrespectful of authority. And when they're thinking of Americans, they think they're overweight. I've heard this from Koreans on a number of occasions. And whenever I travel outside of the U.S. and come back to the U.S., I'm astonished how overweight Americans are in comparison with populations in the rest of the world. Swedes think others are hurried. They're too individualistic. They're uncaring. They're often incorrect and improper in their business dealings, and they're often aggressive and bulldozing. So now your Korean is the leader. And he might wonder, why are these people being so subversive? Why are they fighting against me so much? Americans think of others as slow and old-fashioned, cautious. Why don't you just fix it? Why don't you just make it right? Here's what you need to do. I have 3 steps. They all start with the letter P and they all end with ING. And if you just follow these 3 steps, your problems will be cured and fixed. They're impractical. They can think of others as devious or afraid of change and innovation. I'm not going to walk through all of these, but every person here in this room, every person watching this video, carries stereotypes. It's not easy to get past them, and when you're new to a team, you've carried those in with you. And sometimes you form them as a result of being on a team, and they might be on the basis of one person. So you look at the different types of leadership style. See, the German style, headquarters determines what's right, and everybody simply follows in line, but you all know your place in their hierarchy. The South Koreans have a consensus rule, and there will be elders at the top that will make the decision, and everybody else will agree with it. Swedes, on the other hand, have a first among equals, and they want to make sure everybody gets a voice at the table in what's going on. Americans have this massive structured individualism with tables and charts, and you know where you stand sometimes. It's always been interesting at a place like Wheaton, where I report to more than one boss simultaneously, to know just what that means and how I'm supposed to handle that. And when the bosses give conflicting things to do, then usually I have to go to a boss above both of them to mediate between the two and make sure I can know what it is I'm supposed to do so I don't get in trouble in one direction or the other. So now, what I'm showing here is teams can get stuck in this phase and move into a car accident. They can start trying to cut each other off. These are unhealthy patterns that teams can move into at this unconscious, incompetent stage. You can make decisions that are not helpful. So I asked a Kenyan once in a cross-cultural communication class, if I invited you to eat dinner with me at 6 o'clock and you wanted to show me you're my friend, what time would you come? And he said, a little bit late. And I said, how late is that? He said, about 1 hour. So you can imagine if a German invited a Kenyan to dinner and the Kenyan showed up an hour late, what do you think the German would do?
Leave.
He wouldn't be there, but if it was at his house, he wouldn't open the door, or something like this, right? And the Kenyan would have no idea why that relationship has become a broken relationship. But he would know that the German only ever means business. He doesn't want a real friendship. He just wants business. Now, again, I stepped out of the four roles we have in the team. The four that we have here tend to be more punctual than other groups tend to be. So blind spots. German's blind spot is subtle humor. So the British and the Germans don't always understand each other very well because the British are very good at subtle humor, following the stereotype. The South Korean blind spot is their distorted worldview due to excessive nationalism. The Korean way is the best way. I went to a group called Two Wings, which you probably have never heard of, but it's like a purpose-driven type of approach, but don't think of the content of purpose-driven, just think of purpose-driven as an orientation towards what a healthy church should be. This is a Korean orientation. I was there for a week speaking. I had 6 hours of lectures that I listened to on Two Wings methodology, and I came away still not knowing what it was because it was done in a Korean fashion that I didn't get, but they were saying we are the healthiest church in the world as proven by a German researcher. So they were very happy to point that out as being the healthiest church in the world, but there was an element of nationalism that was there that was part of it. Americans, there are no blind spots for Americans, right? Sure there are. Insensitivity to non-American values. America is the best. Have you ever heard the word humble and American used in the same sentence? Without a not somewhere in between? No, I've never heard those two words put together when spoken by someone who's not an American. The Swedes can be slow decision makers because they want to make sure everybody is on board with the decision. And so they're waiting and waiting, and they can be complacent with things. And that's, again, blind spots that are built on stereotypes. A third way, you begin to move past the conflict and you begin to think about how to behave, how to understand decisions in light of the team members' culture. It's not an easy place to get to, and you have to work on it together. And one of the elements of third way is you form a culture that is not the culture of any individual team member. It's a culture comprised of bits and pieces of the various members of the team. And so you conscious competence now begins to emerge. Team members change expectations they have of teammates. Perhaps they say, yes, our Swede leader is a bit late again because he's just relaxed, but that's okay. And when you hear the German saying that, you know that the German has begun to accept that as part of Swedish nature rather than trying to correct the Swedish person by always showing up 15 minutes early, hoping the Swede will come sooner. If that happens to be a problem. Conscious, you have to think about it, for otherness takes place. In a society that produces large power distance, how does that impact something like eye contact? When I was teaching in Swaziland, I was told by my American teachers that the Swazis will never look you in the eye. And we actually had one 12th grader who was caned by a Swazi teacher for looking him in the eyes. And yet in the United States we're taught, if you're not looking me in the eyes, you're probably not listening to me. But in Swaziland, that looking me in the eyes meant disrespect. And I realized every time I was on staff with Campus Crusade, every time I would share with the Swazi, they would always, always receive Christ. And I made sure I maintained good eye contact with them, looking directly in the eye. Well, what I didn't understand was I was playing a power game with them. And they were saying yes, not to Christ, but to my power. And for the most part, I'm not that tall. I'm just under 6 feet, but I was taller than most Swazis. So I was always looking down on them and looking them right in the eyes and made sure I had that good communication. About a year and a half into the country, I started, okay, I'm always getting yeses, but I don't know what they mean. So I started watching how Swazis would witness to each other, and I noticed they never looked each other right in the eyes. And I started trying to observe, and I realized they're looking about 6 inches on the other side of the head, then they swing to this side of the head, and they might glance, but they don't really look. And I started doing that, and people suddenly stopped saying yes, because it was no longer a power issue. But I had to think about that. It was very hard to talk to somebody and look 6 inches on the side of their face for me. I had to consciously force myself to do that. And I was just there another year or so. It takes longer than that for a habit that's been learned over 20 years to change it so it actually becomes an unconscious habit. It was still a conscious habit when I left Swaziland. And I can go back to it, but it would take me years to get to the stage where it would become an unconscious habit. Trust is an important component of team unity. The team must trust the leader, and they must know that the leader trusts them, and they must trust each other. But trust is built in social relationships on the basis of behavior. Can I trust you to be on time? Can I trust you not to be abusive? Can I trust you not to be power hungry? Can I trust that you really want to have a relationship with me? A Ugandan told me once, a student told me, there's nothing I would love for you to do than to come unannounced and visit me and sit and talk for a few hours and never tell me why you came. Because when you tell me why you came, it's business. And then you take your leave and you go. He said, then I know you're a friend. Then I know I have a relationship with you. Otherwise, I'm just coming for business. And so my wife and I started doing that. Now, we're Americans, so Thursday nights at 7 o'clock, we would go visit our students. I can't imagine doing that with my American students. They would have no clue, and I guarantee you within 10 seconds of me knocking on their door, they would be, how can I help you? Why did I fail something? What's wrong? What did I do that's wrong? Whereas the Kenyans never asked that question, and we never told them why they came, why we came. It was hard. We had to practice not telling them why we were there, because you just want to blurt it out, because culturally we learned growing up that you have to ask permission to take somebody's time. And it's very impolite just to impose on them. And as far as Kenyans were concerned, this is not an imposition. This is a relationship. But trust is built in culturally appropriate ways. And this walks through several steps, forging strong emotional bonds, identifying and examining hidden assumptions. I'm not saying that's what the Korean, that's what the American. These are all steps that are important in process of developing a team that's working through the entire set of processes. And there should be a URL at the end that will tell you where you can go online and see the Prezi as well, too, so you don't have to just rely on this material. And then the last stage was the stage of effective synergy. This is a stage where you're not consciously thinking about what it takes to be competent because you've learned each other. You know each other that well. How long does it take for that to form? Probably doesn't happen in the space of a year. You've got to give it more time than that. And part of the challenge in mission teams is they're constantly changing. People are going on home assignment. New people are joining the team. So it's hard to have a cohesive, coherent, and long-term team culture. Your team culture has to be changing on a regular basis as new members come and go. And as people connect with each other in ways they haven't before. So say two team members fall in love and decide to get married and they're from two different cultures. That changes the dynamic in and of itself without even having to add another teammate. Because then they're learning a pattern within their marriage of how they relate to each other that's different than they've had before as teammates. The team culture becomes the norm. There are fluid inter-team dynamics. In the best of worlds, there's a shared mission and vision of the team guides people without them being so mission-driven that they forget the relationships, because the relationships are critical for the team to go well and the team is effective. Okay, so these are characteristics. They have positive attitudes towards other cultures. They're humble. I didn't put that towards the American on purpose. Respectful of others. They're inclusive. They're self-aware. Learning, ready to try new ways to do things. They're patient, they're ready to listen, and they're approachable when the best teams are working together. And when we have time for questions, you might ask, how in the world do you get to that? I wish I had an easy answer to tell you. It takes time and work. There's not much of a way around that. And patience. So what are some basic team patterns? We're still looking at this particular sample team. Healthy teams have this: relationships are healthy, each person feels safe and valued, there's a sense of common identity, and members are learning and growing. It's hard to have a healthy team when you have one member who simply is unhealthy to begin with. And that's a challenge for agencies and agency leaders. I've heard an adage that says that one third of missionaries spend all of their time looking out for the second third of missionaries, and it's the third third of missionaries who actually can do the work that they're there to do. I don't know how true that is, but I experienced a lot of dysfunctionality on the field that was just hard to get past in developing a good team. So we're back to this same sample team, and what are the strengths that the Germans bring to the team? I'm not going to go through all four of these. I'll read one each time, and I'll read a different one each time. They're technical details. They're good at forward planning, and keeping to schedules is important for them. They can spot difficulties and try to avoid future problems. They'll be very quick to spot the difficulties and tell you about them and anticipate them. And if that makes you lose face, it's a challenge then in the team dynamics, but this is one of the strengths they bring to the team. Quality communication involves being honest whether it's pleasant or not for the Germans. Your German is atrocious from the taxi driver. But for Americans, in an ideal world, this is not true of all Americans, you spell it all out in a frank, open manner. Whereas the Koreans, you don't want to lose face, and you don't want to make people lose face by what you say. Because if you make me lose face, together we lose face. It's not just me and it's not just you. Insights. The Swedes have good collective skills and they're good at planning. The Koreans are energetic, hardworking, good planners. That mission agency I mentioned, I think they probably average 80 hours a week. They're full-time workers and then they do evangelism on college campuses where they're located. Koreans are, I've heard that group described as, you're familiar with navigators and discipleship methodologies and their discipline. They're navigators on steroids, drinking caffeine. and that's the way to describe many South Koreans in terms of their work ethic. I put this in there because as an American, I tend to love brainstorming, coming up with collective ideas and just bringing ideas out. Koreans don't like brainstorming as much because it means I need to voice an individual idea rather than letting the group come together around a common idea. Germans are a little bit more skeptical. The American has a green light. I'm using stoplight analogies here. The Germans, few Germans wish to contradict superiors or disagree openly. As they also wish to be honest, brainstorming presents a dilemma. They'd rather have processes that they work through than an open-ended style that leaves them feeling uncomfortable. The Swedes love long discussions. How does that make the Germans feel? Decision-making styles. Management in Germans, autocratic with consensus. Management with Swedes, democratic, low-key managers. So we've chosen a Swedish person as the leader of this group. What is the German likely to think about the Swedish leader? He's not a very good leader.
Weak leader.
The Korean likely will think that as well, too. They do have a collective decision-making method that's consensus, but sometimes they prefer to have the consensus told to them than come up with it themselves. Americans, let's get to the bottom line. Let's be pragmatic about it. We like brainstorming. We like being action-oriented. Now, the preferred communication styles, and this is one I'd be interested with your input on it. This is not one I came up with. This came out of some cross-cultural communicators. Germans like to follow the agenda. They have a prompt start, a review of past history. You know, it's block, 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 a short time of resistance, then absorb counter-argument, offer new counter-proposal, cautious but firm agreement, and the truth is the truth. As long as you're following the agenda and walking through the process. This is the stereotype, and I understand that. Koreans. Korean elastic truth. Elastic truth means I'm speaking in light of the relationships I have, not in terms of the ideas that we're arguing over. So they're creative, they got flashes of humor, then they moved to serious and intense. I was just speaking in Korea, and the first day of the class, they invited outside people to come. The class had 10 students, and they had 30 people come the first day to hear. And they were very excited about having that many, but they had to change the location because the church we were going to meet didn't have facilities for 30 people. So we went to a larger church, a pastor of higher social status, and my Korean translator was very nervous. He works for an American school, and he wanted things to go well. And after 1 hour of my initial lecture, they were taking a break, and he came up to me and said, "This is not going well. You're too American." And I said, "Well, I am American. It's it's hard not to be too American." He said, "You need to be more practical." I said, "Okay, what does that look like?" "You just need to be more practical. And you need to be funny. You're losing them all." And I thought, okay, so I started trying to pull out things. And cross-cultural humor is exceedingly difficult because you don't know why people are laughing at times when they're laughing. It's a tremendous challenge that I was unable to adapt to. It's the first time I felt my teaching was a failure. We had lunch, and it was supposed to go from 9 o'clock until 5 o'clock. And after lunch, they came up and told me just before, so we'll close at 2, okay? Which tells me, okay, things did not go the way they wanted them to go. The rest of the week went very well with the 10 students. But I left still not knowing what they wanted out of that first day. It's like they wanted to attract students into the program with something that wasn't the program. And so for me, it felt it was false advertising as an American. I would rather teach the way I'm going to for the week, but they wanted to bring people in. That was that creative flashes of humor right at the beginning. They wanted that part to shine, and I didn't. And so that was part of my experience here. If you don't learn from your failures, there's a problem with that, because all of us have failures we have to walk through and deal with. And, you know, relative truth, only give good news. They say what they think you want to hear on the basis of how long they've been with you. By the end of the week, my relationships were good with the students. The translator and I had sorted things out. He said I was nervous. I was scared that first day. I wanted it to go well. But I still have this scar that's part of my relationship with him. So the next time I teach and he's my translator, he's the only person who translates for their Korean program, I know that will be something that will be a potential barrier between me and him. And right now, I'm not sure how to fix it. But if he and I were on a team together in the long haul, we would have to find a way to walk through that and debrief it and understand it better. Americans, you want to put all the cards on the table, spell it all out. If it's not going well, you do it louder, because you're monolingual. You're willing to provoke, to fight. You bring in sarcasm. You always realize that a fight itself is communication. At the end, you finally come to concessions and conciliation. You have summary, and then you're good to go. I look at this as an American, and I say, I'm not sure I buy this. You might look at it as a non-American and say, oh no, this fits all the Americans I've ever seen. You can tell me whether that works or not. The Swede, you know, you set the scene, you're formal, correct, and proper, you have plenty of context, you get a little resistance, then you go round and round and round and round, and you come to a consensus, and you give a summary, and there might be a little more resistance to summary, then there's a reluctance to seek a new consensus, but then at the end you say the Swedish way is best. I didn't come up with these diagrams, but these were diagrams in management styles in other cultures that people who have observed them try to make sense of them as non-Swedes. I think we're just about out of time, so let me go ahead and close us in prayer, and then I'll hang around for a few minutes if you want to talk, but let me pray. Oh, Father, this can be some of the most complicated relationships that we face. I pray for my sisters and my brothers here who are likely part of multicultural teams or overseeing multicultural teams. Bring insights to their mind on things they can implement, enable them to think more clearly about their teams, perhaps to break some of the log jams that they found themselves in. Enable them to move forward in a way that creates better team unity, or enables the teams that they oversee to generate better unity as well, too. Thank you for this time that we have together, and we ask for you to bless the words that come from your heart and to dismiss the words that might not fit with your frame of reference. And we pray this in the name of Jesus. Amen.